Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I am your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing the Samoa Agreement and the controversies surrounding it. I'm joined by a very special guest, Mr. Ben Figo Ezeamalu. Ben is the chief correspondent at Africa Report, based in Nigeria. Ben, you have been reporting on various socio-economic, socio-political issues in Africa. And I think particularly you've written some commentary on this issue. So I look forward to a very exciting conversation with you.
Thank you very much.
Let me begin with, before we get to the controversy, what is the Samoa Agreement?
Yeah, it's... It's basically an agreement that, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's basically an agreement between African countries, the EU, and Caribbean and Pacific states. You know, essentially a cooperation agreement so that the countries can cooperate among one another in terms of various issues like human rights, economic development, and other things, you know. So that's basically the main scope of the agreement, essentially.
It looks like this agreement was signed late last year, and it's superseded an existing agreement, which was, I think, the Cotonou agreement, which was signed in 2000. How is this agreement different? Is it markedly different from the Cotonou agreement?
It's not really very different, because the Cotonou agreement was, you know, it has a lifespan of about 20 years. You know, so when it expired, late last year or so, around 2017, thereabouts, you know. Anyway, it expired and they needed to, you know, continue on that pedestal. So that's how the Samoa Agreement came into being. So it's sort of an extension or like a successor to the Cotonou Agreement, you know. Yeah,
we've seen. So, in my own research, I think in the past I've criticized, not necessarily constructively, the EU-Africa agreement. The Cotonou. Look at it. Although it has some pillars, you can see human rights, development, economic, and then the migration. But there seems to be a focus on migration, and it seems to be the strategic interest of the EU. So if I look at it moving forward, why in my own research, I've always said that everyone has interests, So the EU has their own interests. The African government have their own interests. But do you think the interests of the African government or the African people have been clearly addressed or represented in these summer agreements? Looking from, if you look at the past and look at what's going on in the Sahel and, you know, insecurities and the migration issues. So do you think those issues have been addressed in this summer agreement?
I wouldn't say they've been addressed, because the issue of migration continues to be a very contentious issue, especially for the EU countries. You know, we are currently witnessing a wave of migration into the EU, you know, and the EU countries are, you know, they've always been skeptical about that part of that clause in the agreement. You know, I know, for example, that Hungary refused to sign because they didn't have clarity on the areas of migration, you know, so they withheld their signature, you know, and a few other EU countries also did the same thing, you know. So it's looked as if it's sort of encouraged a wave of immigration into the EU, which the EU countries didn't subscribe to, essentially, you know. So it remains contentious anyway, and I'm hoping that as you know, as the years go by, they are able to sort of streamline that issue and look at how it will be a win-win for all the parties in that agreement.
You know, speaking of migration, let me just digress a little bit. So you mentioned that the wave of migration into Europe, and then, you know, this is sometimes we see, you're in the media, you see the boats, the, you know, the small boats coming into Europe and all that. But some people have also argued that is somewhat exaggerated, or that if we compare it to migration within Africa itself, that is like very little percentage compared to the migration that happened within Africa. So do you agree with that assessment?
I am not quite sure I do 100%, because you only need to look at the fatalities that have been recorded and people trying to cross into Spain from Morocco, cross into Italy. You know, you look at the IOM figures on the number of people who died on the sea, and it's still high. You know, it means that people are still trying to get to the EU countries, essentially. You know, so I do not think that the numbers are exaggerated. I think that it basically reflects on what we are seeing, because even as I speak to you, there are still people here in Nigeria who are still trying to go through the Sahara Desert route, you know, to get to even though Libya has been, with all its issues, people are still, you know, raising money here in Nigeria to pass through the Sahara route to get to Libya with the aim of getting to their final destination, which is usually either of Spain or Italy. So I don't agree that the numbers have been exaggerated.
So if we look at such desperation, I think as pathetic as that is, it reveals a very fundamental issue or crisis in the continent. So if you look at such desperation to go through, like Riley said, Libya has been very unsettled since the fall of Gaddafi, and yet people are willing to risk their life. People are willing to pay these large sums of money to pass through such dangerous routes and go through such, you know, very dangerous journey. But what it reveals is the stuff, the desperation, the things that are pushing people. So it might be maybe insecurity in some places. It might be lack of economic opportunity in some places. But is the Samoa Agreement, does it address these fundamental root causes? Are the governments of Africa, when signing this thing, do they look at it? Because if you look at some of the bilateral agreements, immigration, let's say UK and Rwanda, for instance. So you say, are they really addressing, or are they just dealing with the symptoms rather than addressing the root cause?
Well, I don't think that the Samoa agreements set out to address the issue of migration. You know, that was not the core objective of the agreement, you know. But that came up along the way, you know, because and it mostly came up because the EU member states were kicking against that clause of the agreement. So that's why it became a contentious issue, you know, because it would have allowed free movement essentially into and out of the EU. You know, but when they saw that, they didn't, you know, they felt like don't also forget that not just Africa, the Syria war, the Afghanistan problem, and all those other issues, you know, there was also a wave of immigrants from that part of the globe into Europe, you know. So it's like Europe became a sort of a dumping ground of people from all the other continents. You know, so that's why that clause of the agreement became quite contentious, because why the EU said they are committed to promoting human rights issues, human rights values, and other issues that have to do with sovereignty, that issue of migration became sort of what a lot of the countries in the EU needed to get clarity on what it means for them if they became signatories to the agreement, you know. And to the best of my knowledge, I am not sure that has been 100% solved. You know, there are still gray areas that need to be clarified, you know. So that remains a problem. Migration and, of course, LGBT issue, those are the two issues that really become quite problematic over the
years. You've clearly ties into my next question. So why in the EU we can clearly see that the sticking point or the key controversy for them was the migration in Africa, but I think particularly maybe in Africa and some Caribbean countries, the sticking point of the main issue has been issue of LGBT. You and stuff. What is the root of this controversy in Africa regarding this agreement?
So before I talk about this, I want to clarify that the issue of LGBT was not peculiar to African countries. It was some EU countries also flagged that, you know. Okay. So it wasn't just an African thing. So some European countries didn't also, you know, they would need it. Again, they needed to be clear on what it means for their citizens, essentially, you know. But the controversy essentially arose because when the Nigerian media reported the story, it looked as if Nigeria signing the agreement would now sort of encourage, because we already have a law against LGBT. You know, and when it was reported that Nigeria has signed the Samoa Agreement, it looked as if it's going to be a conflict with Nigerian laws, you know, and because of Nigeria's economic crisis, you know, it looked as if they were, you know, desperate to get money from any angle, irrespective of what the condition is. You know, so but the way the media reported it in Nigeria, the media didn't do justice to the story, you know, in the sense that the first story that was published by a Nigerian newspaper, you know, it sort of it interviewed people, analysts who, you know, I'm not quite sure they really studied the agreement, you know, so they were not up to date with the clauses in the agreement, you know, because the first draft that was submitted had that LGBT clause in it, you know. But when countries started to raise issues with that, African countries, EU countries, and some other the Pacific countries also, you know. So they had to, you know, rework the draft to remove the part that had the LGBT clause.
Hmm.
So the final one that was passed didn't have the LGBT clause. So now, if you did not see the final clause, if you didn't see the final agreement, you would assume that the LGBT was part of what was passed in the agreement, you know, but it was removed. So a lot of people didn't know that. So that was what triggered the controversy, essentially, you know. And of course, Nigerian officials had to, you know, double back and, you know, try to put some clarity that, look, this is not the case, you know, because there's no way the country is going to be a signatory to any agreement that would be at loggerheads with the local laws. So it sort of clarified, yeah. So that part is no longer, they were able to sort out all the controversies.
Okay, and this also brings back to well, this opens up some you know, kind of form a wider issue. So that means there's no, you know, like they say, there's no fire without, there's no smoke without a fire. So from your explanation now, it did seem that even though the final clause didn't have that explicit, you know, LGBT, the initial draft had the LGBT clause. So would you say in that instance, would you say that there is some level of validity in the claim of those that were, you know, that are airing this opinion of the LGBT?
Well, I think the whole point of the controversy is because and I'll speak for Nigeria because I'm a Nigerian, you know. The whole point of the controversy regarding that part of the agreement for Nigerians is that because we already have a law that criminalizes LGBTQ, you know, it's a criminal act, you know. So, and also because not just LGBT, we also had abortion rights that they thought was in the agreement, and also teen sexual. So the LGBTQ and abortion rights, those two items are, Nigeria frowns against that, against those two items, you know. So yeah, I can understand the uproar, the outrage by people, not just in Nigeria and also within the continent, with that aspect of the agreement, you know. So, but because the media did not do what it was supposed to do ab initio, you know, to properly educate the people, you know. So their concerns were legitimate because that's what they were fed, you know. If they had known that the final agreement did not have those issues, there was no need for them to rise up and be making basically like a storm in a teacup kind of reaction, you know. So yeah, their grouses were legitimate because that was what they thought was passed, you know. But you could see that over the past few weeks, when clarity had set in, that the outrage had, you know, simmered down. People have, you know, realized that, look, we didn't have to go to war in the first place.
But some people still don't feel pacified by that. I think I was reading somewhere the lawyer that kind of like it first sparked that reaction. I think Sonny Ekwusu, in his first opinion piece in the Banker, even though with this rephrased and refined clause, he still doubled down on his claim that this is just an euphemism for still passing the same stuff. So he said, he talked about, I think it's article 2.5, where they talk about promoting gender equality and then Article 29.5, where they're talking about universal access to sexual. So it's just talking about languaging. So what he's saying is they've only just watered down the language, but it's still the same thing. Do you agree with his view on that?
No, I don't agree, because the Article 2.5 that you spoke about, you know, talked about gender equality. So I think that's pretty much clear. You know, we don't have gender issues here in Nigeria. There's no law against gender in Nigeria. Now, the 29.5 that spoke about universal access to sexual and reproductive rights, basically, you know, it's open to interpretation, because it's not specific. It did not say that LGBT rights should be encouraged, you know, and because it didn't state that explicitly, so there is no basis for anyone to now impute LGBT rights into the agreement, because it was in the initial draft, but it was removed, you know. So if you are saying that sexual rights is also the same as LGBT rights, and the countries that signed it eventually, who disputed the initial draft and then signed the final draft that was the agreement. If you are saying that those people signed it despite seeing the clause about sexual rights, it means that they didn't have raised dust in the first place when they saw the LGBT rights that was in the initial draft, you know. So in my interpretation, I believe that whatever is said about sexual rights does not mean that parties should, you know, accept LGBT rights in their respective countries. I didn't think that's what it meant, you know, because and again, I mean, the agreement is on the website of this guy. So anyone can go and read the entire document, because sometimes you also need to, you know, read the entire document and not just extrapolate individual articles to, you know, you read the entire clause, the entire sections to get a clearer picture of what the agreement is talking about, basically.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Like, in Nigeria, though, we can say the law, you know, in terms of like gender, but in practice, there's been very limited. Clearly, there's no gender equality in Nigeria. If you compare it to a place like South Africa or a place like Rwanda, where perhaps you could have nearly 50% of the people in the parliament are women, and in Nigeria, you know, you don't have those things. And then again, you look at in Nigeria, so where we've mainstreamed the Gender Equality Act, or, you know, the 30% gender, UN gender. So I can see where you're coming from in terms of, like, you can see that it's part misinformation from some of these people, but you can also see where.
Yeah, I agree.
You can also see where, again, they have a point where they're coming from.
But
what it does expose is a bigger, wider problem in Africa, whereby Africa that is aid dependent, and by being aid dependent, especially from the EU or from the West as a whole, Africa has been subjected to conditions where. So I think that's the big issue, where Africa has to be subjected to conditions for aid. What is your take on that, especially in the light of not necessarily new, like other superpowers like China, Russia coming in without those kind of conditions? How do you compare all of that?
I think Africa has itself to blame in this situation, because there is no need for the continent to be where it is today, where it has to always be going cap in hand to beg from the West, you know. If Africa had lived up to its potentials, I mean, before we were born, we've been talking about Africa rising, you know, and 40 years later, we're still talking about Africa rising. When will Africa rise? Is it after a million years? You know, and don't forget that the resources that Africa has, they at some point, they are going to be depleted. They're not going to be there forever. You know, so if the continent has not been able to exploit its strengths, you know, sort of to use it as a leverage, because you can't, what happens is that the West comes in to the continent to, you know, exploit the natural resources and take it back to their countries, you know. So we are basically the provider of raw materials. We don't deal with the finished, and then they bring it back to us, you know. So as long as the continent remains on that pedestal, you know, it's going to be a continuous issue that the continent will always be subservient to the West, you know. In terms of, I mean, I remember when Uganda passed the anti-LGBT law, and then the U.S. had problem with that, and they threatened to cut them off from the AGOA agreement. AGOA is an agreement between the U.S. and African countries. Yeah. So they threatened to cut them off from the AGOA agreement. And so we have a sort of a stick and carrot situation where they need to beat you into line, you know, for you to assess the aid from them, you know. But if Africa had done what it was supposed to do, nobody, I mean, look at China, for example. Nobody is beating China for whatever they are doing in their country, you know. So if Africa had been at that level, we would be able to dictate, you know, on our own terms, not on the other party's terms. So it's unfortunate, but that's our reality in 2024.
I'm coming towards the, but there are two very important questions that stem from what you just said now, in terms of Africa being exporter of raw materials and importer of finished goods. In Nigeria currently, we've seen where with the current administration have been able to do what other administrations have failed to do in terms of removing the fuel subsidy. And then there's been a question of where, so the controversy, I think, surrounding the Dangote refinery, where you remove that. And I'm just going back to what you're saying in terms of refinery, and then the refinery is not working. You're here, we're importing some oil from Malta. Where you do that. I think that kind of like speaks into what you're saying about Africa has itself to blame. But is who are these people holding to ransom the African development? Are these leaders? Is it just African leaders, or do you have external people involved in this?
Well, I think, you know, we have a saying in my community that it is the rat in the house that will tell the rat outside that there is food in the house, you know. If those within the continent, you know, did not allow those outside the continent to come in, they would not have come in, you know. So African leaders over the years, they have not lived up to potential. They have not done what they are supposed to. I mean, every time people point to China, people point to Malaysia and Indonesia, the Asian tigers, you know. You can see the quality of the leadership that moved them from where they were in the 1960s to where they are in as we speak, you know. And you could measure the progress they have made over these decades, you know. But for Africa, it has not been the same. So we've had leaders who are not interested in developing the continent. They are rather interested in enriching themselves, you know. So leaders are to blame. The followers also share in the blame, you know, because you look at the countries that practice democracy and you look at the crop of leaders that they have, and every election, they keep re-electing them, you know. For example, I mean, you're a Nigerian, I'm a Nigerian. Every election cycle, the main issues that are being debated, that are debated, is usually issue of religion, ethnicity, and those banal things that don't even that shouldn't, nobody's talking about the manifesto of the candidate. You know, it's always about where the candidate is from, is one of us. So as long as we are within that circle, we'll continue to be in that circle. You know, there is no two ways about it. It's not magic or rocket science. You have to tackle issues that will take you out of poverty. If you don't tackle them, you remain in poverty. That's just the way it is. Leaders, followers, they all share in the blame. It's not the West. The foreigners are not to be blamed because we allow them to come. You know, if we were doing well, they wouldn't come to exploit whatever we have here. So
I agree with you. There's something you mentioned that I want to take you up on, and I want to finish on that note. So if you talk about the role that the followers play, and then we can talk. You mentioned something earlier on, you're talking about the media not educating the people. Well, so that means the media, we often talk about the leaders, the political leaders, but the media also plays a very huge role, important role in the health of a society. So if we talk about media disinformation and all of this, and talk about the followers as well, we also talk about, it also lean into the level of education of that we have, the quality of education for people to be a critical crop of people to understand things. So if we talk about media disinformation, I wanted to see, how do you think the media can be improved in Nigeria? You've been part of that media. How do you think the media in Nigeria can be improved and become a force for good, a force for change? And if you just end on that note.
Yeah, I think the number one thing for the Nigerian media is the welfare of journalists. You know, that's, everything boils down to the welfare of the media practitioners. You know, for as long as they are poorly paid, they are not properly equipped, they are not motivated, you know, we are going to be stuck in this cycle of, you know, poorly researched stories, misinformation by the media, and poorly written stories. You know, so that's one. The media, there need to be a deliberate approach, a deliberate strategy to improve the condition of service of journalists in Nigeria. You know, once you fix that, and then you can come to the issue of training. You know, because for example, the story that triggered this whole controversy, you know, if the analyst that was interviewed was properly fact-checked in the story, you know, there wouldn't have been this outrage. You know, so what we had was, the story was published, and then you have other media doing a fact checking the story, you know. But don't forget that those who read the initial story might not see the fact check that came afterwards. You know, so the proper thing to do now, you know, is, because every media house ought to have a fact checking desk as part of their daily operations. So that at every story, once a politician, an analyst, whoever makes a contextual statement, the person is fact checked right there inside the story. You know, so that's very important. And I think that on that aspect, I think we are making some progress, because a lot of media houses now, they are having fact check desk, and we also have fact checkers. You know, like Africa Check, Dubawa, also there to always ready to help whenever they're called upon. You know, and you could see that during the last presidential debate, where you had fact checkers at the debates, you know, once the candidates speak, then the fact checkers will there and then. So it's no longer a case of fact checking them 24 hours later or 2 days. You are doing it there and then. So we need to do that. So welfare training, and also the third one I think that needs to be done is the economy of the country, because the journalists are also part of the economy, you know. So even if you are paying a journalist $1 million every month and he spends 70% of that on foodstuff, you know, you are still not, you know, nothing has changed essentially, you know. So the economy also needs to improve for people to have a better life, you know, better security, you know, and all the other things that make life easy, you know. So that's things that need to, in my opinion, that we need to get right for us to get to at least be on the path of where we want to be.
Wow, thank you very much, Ben. I really appreciate your first of all honoring the invitation, and also appreciate your brilliant analysis and insight into this issue and controversies. We thank you for coming, and thank you very, very much. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode. That is my conversation with Ben Ezeamalu, the chief correspondent at Africa Report. Join me as usual to thank him for his rich and interesting insight into the Samoa EU-African Caribbean Pacific Agreement and the controversies that have emerged from this agreement. I implore you to join me again next week for another exciting episode. For now, take care.